Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane while she's visiting WMFE in Orlando, Florida. She'll be back in this chair on Monday. Osama bin Laden threatened France in a new audio tape deemed authentic by French officials. The al-Qaeda leader warned France against keeping troops in Afghanistan and banning face veils. French unions staged nationwide strikes again to protest a pension reform bill approved by lawmakers. An Iraqi court sentenced former Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz to death. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton traveled to Asia to lay the groundwork for President Obama's upcoming tour of that continent. Joining me in the studio to discuss the week's top international stories on our Friday news roundup, Roy Gutman of McClatchy Newspaper, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, Martin Walker of UPI. Welcome to you all.
Morning.
Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join our conversation, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Roy, let's talk some about the strikes in France. A dramatic move by the French government to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62, full pension rights from 65 to 67. Unions, as they often do in France, taking to the streets to protest this. Significance of what we're seeing.
Europe in general has supported welfare statism really since World War II, and France has been one of the most advanced countries in that regard, with terrific benefits, both in health care and in retirement and pension benefits. And it just can't be paid for any longer. And I think President Sarkozy, in demanding changes, really was telling the French what they already knew but hadn't been willing to admit. Now, it's quite interesting that the strikes, and the French are really good at staging strikes and very proficient and certainly have tremendous experience in doing it. Really, this time didn't carry it off. The latest strikes, I guess, yesterday and on Thursday. In fact, the numbers seem to be fairly low in Paris and in other major cities, including Marseille. I think probably the French public itself has had enough of that, street democracy. It's certainly not a modern thing, and it's inappropriate when everybody else is trying to tighten their belts.
And when you talk about everybody else, Martin, you follow politics UK very closely, and this Sarkozy move dovetails with, in some ways, even more harsh austerity measures the Cameron government in Britain. Link these two stories. What's this pattern we're seeing?
Well, the irony of this is that the two great dramas over the funding of the welfare state, and Roy's absolutely right about that, are taking place in the two countries, Britain and France, which have got the healthiest demographic profiles in Europe. In other words, they've got enough young people, a high enough birth rate, that they're going to be able much more easily than, say, Germany or Italy to finance pensions and welfare way into the future. I mean, for example, by 2030, 36% of all Germans will be over the age of 60. And at that point, it'll be about 27.5% of Brits and about 22% of Americans. And that's the key, that's the key demographic figure. And the British and the French are doing this, I think, because they have got a much stronger tradition of a powerful centralized government, whereas Germany is a very federalized system. In Britain, the cuts are going to be in almost all departments except for defense, health, and foreign aid, about 25% of budgets. They're going to be cutting about 10% altogether of public spending over the next 3 years. This is the toughest austerity that Britain has seen since World War II, or that any European has, Western European country has seen for the last 60 years. In France, Roy is absolutely right. The strikes have been fading, but the reason for that is twofold. And the important one is that the law was changed. And since the last great attempt to reform the French social system under Prime Minister Juppé in 95, a law has been passed which requires all unions to maintain a skeleton a skeleton basic service in things like transport, healthcare, and teaching, and so on. So you kind of have the complete close down. Mm-hmm. Even with the old Marine Corps of the French Labor Union, which was the CGT, the Confédération Générale du Travail, which was the Communist Union, and yeah. they ran the railroads, and even they weren't able to bring the railroads to a halt this time. So, and Roy, I think, is right that broadly speaking, a majority of the French seemed to realize the game was up. There were majorities both in the Senate and in the Assemblée Nationale, the French Parliament, to pass this law. And it's, by most European standards, it's a pretty feeble law. It doesn't really do the trick.
Well, Susan, to that point, also this week, the EU meeting on this very subject, under the prodding from the Germans primarily, committing themselves to a tougher regime of imposing the rules on budget austerity on, you know, you've got 27 countries in the EU. Bring us up to date on that dimension of it.
Well, I think that's a very important development. What you're seeing is, you know, certainly different manifestations in Britain and in France, but, you know, across Europe, you're seeing a level of austerity and belt tightening, if you will, that is really unprecedented in the history of the EU. And I think it also reflects a very interesting divergence with where the politics in the U.S. are at. You know, as you were saying right before we went on the air, you know, if Britain and France can do this, you know, it's a pretty different path than the one taken so far here in the U.S. Obviously, we have an election coming up on Tuesday, and I think one big question is, what is a new, more Republican-dominated Congress going to do? But what's extraordinary, right, is you have the people who brought us democratic socialism in Western Europe. They're the ones giving up on state spending as a means of, you know, longer-term stimulation of their economy. You know, they're the ones who've thrown Keynes, you know, over the bus, whereas here there's still a very robust argument among our economists and our sort of thinking chattering classes about whether the problem is insufficient stimulus to restart in an aggressive way a more robust American recovery and jobs recovery. So I think you see, number one, a real different path being taken by Europe and the United States right now, and that's something we haven't seen so starkly recently. Number two, I think it is important to remember, yes, they're tightening their belt in France. They have a big belt. They have a lot that they can tighten. And they're talking about raising the retirement age to 62.
Also, the full retirement age is going to be 67. At 62, you can take a very, very small share of your
pension. You know, two of the key differences, Martin mentioned one of them, the demographics of the United States are different, in part because we have more immigrants, younger immigrants who will pay into the Social Security system. And then also, the dollar is a reserve currency, and China will finance our debt in ways that China will not finance some of the European debt. So the pressures on the EU, as we saw just this week, to put in belt-tightening measures is partly as a result of the fact that they don't have that flexibility in the international financing of their debt.
Well, this was what yesterday's European summit in Brussels was all about. Right. It was trying to keep going this kind of huge rescue mechanism they set in train back in May because of the Greek crisis. And that funds at about $900 billion. I mean, it's very nearly $1 trillion is the money putting into it when you count in the euros and the IMF. Share. And this meeting yesterday was the Germans were saying, we will not fund this beyond 2013. And because one needs some kind of mechanism for the future, the huge argument has been, can a new mechanism be brought about without a new European treaty? The last one took 10 years to negotiate. So there's been a kind of a deal between the French and the Germans under which there won't be particularly tough sanctions, but the Germans will come up with the money.
Now, Roy, two other stories involving France this week. One, Osama bin Laden, an audio tape, which has been deemed authentic by most experts. And speaking to, we just mentioned the issue of immigrants in Europe and a French law cracking down on the use of face veils, burqas, by Muslim women, and Osama bin Laden threatening reprisals against the French because of this law. Tell us about that story.
Well, it looks like, I'm just guessing, that the tape was made some weeks ago because it refers to the kidnapping of some French citizens in West Africa. And the essence of it is threats, warnings to the French telling them, as you kill, you will be killed. As you take hostages, we will take hostages. if you insist on banning burqas, we will slit the throats of your soldiers. So it was, vintage Osama. What's rather interesting is that he directed it at France specifically, which hasn't happened, I don't think, before, and that he's out there threatening. The French government has taken it somewhat in stride, but I think they've also heightened security measures all over the place.
And Susan, another related story. Within a day after this threatening message, Sarkozy government announces they're going to start removing troops from Afghanistan. They have about 3,500 troops there now. They've suffered about 50 casualties as part of the NATO detachment in Afghanistan. They insist there's no connection. What's your read on that dimension of the story?
Well, I can't get inside their mind there, but there's no question that in a broad sense, all of the Europeans are looking for their own way to the exit. And in fact, that's part of the concern that some inside the U.S. government had with the July 2011 framework that President Obama laid out for at least the beginning of a drawing down of the U.S. presence, is that, of course, it's much harder to ask your allies to remain for an indefinite period of time when you're starting to put a framework of time on your own presence there, not to mention the potential consequences that, inside the Pentagon are very much feared in Afghanistan and Pakistan by, just saying basically, hey, guys, you can outlast us here. But going back to your Osama bin Laden point, I do think it's interesting that he's explicitly taking on France in a way that he hasn't done before. What you also are seeing, right, is a lot of al-Qaeda online messaging right now that's very focused on the West, actually, that's very focused on potentially activating that sort of electronic jihad. Right now, it's easier than ever, of course, to participate, whether you're in the United States, a la the underpants bomber, or, that sort of thing, the Times Square bomber. And I think you're going to see
and
more.
And filing a plot on the metro here in Washington this week.
The sort of westernization and also Americanization of the electronic jihad is something to watch.
More as we turn our attention to Asia and Afghanistan as our news roundup continues. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and my guests for this international portion of our Friday News Roundup, Roy Gutman of McClatchy, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, formerly of the Washington Post, Martin Walker of UPI. And Martin, as we move our focus from Europe to Asia and talking about the Osama bin Laden tapes and the drawdown of French troops in Afghanistan, one of the news stories this week relating to Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, after first denying the story, then confirms that his government has been, quote, getting bags of cash, unquote, approaching, $1 million from Iran. And he says, well, I use them for my expenses. It's sort of like walking around money in American politics. But give us an update on that story. What's the significance of what we're hearing here?
Well, there was talking of France, there was a rather good commentary, I think it was in François, one of the French newspapers, which said, we never thought that George Bush's attempt to export American democratic practices to Afghanistan would have such success. The point being that they see this as par for the course for U.S. campaign finance. I think the importance of this is that it's it's a bit of a storm in a teacup, in that since the Karzai government really is restricted to Kabul and a few roads outside it, they've got very little tax-raising or fundraising capability. If that presidential office is going to keep going, it's got to get cash from somewhere. Most of the other kinds of aid are pretty thoroughly accounted for because of Western government practices. But that doesn't stop, say, US government and some of the other NATO governments from handing out sacks of cash. Moreover, if you go to Kabul, if you talk to some of the local contractors, it's par for the course to bribe the local Taliban or the local bad guys with bags of cash to give an okay for your trucks to go through.
What is Iran buying with that cash?
Access. Access and perhaps influence. It's probably particularly trying to secure the loyalty of a chap called Dudzai, who is the chief of staff of Karzai.
And former ambassador to Tehran with links to Iran already.
Yeah. And but don't forget, I mean, Dari is the language of the upper class Afghans is very, very close indeed to Farsi. I mean, there's a very long traditional historical link between the two countries. And geography means that whatever happens in Afghanistan is going to be very, very important to Iran.
And also, Roy, as a dimension of this, the Karzai government had issued an edict saying they were going to throw out foreign contractors, security contractors. People don't realize there are 30 to 40,000 of them operating, and there was a protest by Hillary Clinton and others saying, you get rid of these foreign contractors and we can't protect all of the infrastructure projects, all of the aid projects, a clear vote of no confidence in the Afghan police and military forces themselves. Karzai backs off slightly. What's that story?
The security contractors perform a really vital role. They provide protection, especially for convoys traveling through the country. They charge per truck, like at least $100 sometimes.
And as Martin was saying, the government really doesn't have a writ beyond a few roads outside of Kabul.
No, and these contractors pay off the Taliban. They also annoy the local population because they run rampant, just like any security contractors, and sometimes armies do as well. I think Karzai has a very strong point that that this should be under the control of the Afghan government. Unfortunately, the Afghan government cannot, as Martin said, deliver the security that is needed. The other interesting element of it is that, at least in the case of some of the bigger security contractors, major stakes are owned by relatives of President Karzai himself. Mm-hmm. So if he's really going to close them down, it would probably be a good thing. And if he can really turn this over to the state itself, it would be a terrific thing. I think it's highly unlikely they can accomplish this by March. But it is an aspiration that any self-respecting state should have. And we should support it in that regard. But I wouldn't say by that timetable.
But Susan, the fact that the Secretary of State Clinton felt compelled to step in, and this is a part of a much larger question, which is how able is the Karzai government to take over and the military and police functions? Should these timetables we were just talking about, with the French and others pulling out and the Americans pulling out by mid-2011, I mean, this reveals, just by that phone call, reveals her lack of confidence in this infrastructure, right?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, two things. One, the U.S. relationship with Hamid Karzai has been in a state of deep crisis, for at least the last several years. And this is one more sign of it. They've been pivoting back and forth between sort of publicly slapping at each other and behind the scenes slapping at each other, then publicly making up. And why is that? Because they don't have a viable alternative to Karzai. The political process is sort of gridlocked and broken down since the presidential election and the widespread fraud that led to President Karzai's next term in office. You know, basically, relations have never recovered since then. And it has really showcased the U.S. dilemma there, which is to say, you're stuck with him, you don't have an alternative to him, but you can't really work with him anymore.
And part of what is so, you know, when people say, well, why does America continue to care about Afghanistan? What is our national interest? Often it comes back to the question, this is the place where the 9/11 bombers plotted. These wild, mountainous border regions with Pakistan continue to be incubators. You talked about the Osama bin Laden tapes. We believe that Osama bin Laden, I guess you're the expert, Roy, but still a guess that that's where he is. And just now coming over the AP is a story. Law enforcement officials are investigating reports of suspicious packages on cargo planes, Philadelphia and Newark. TSA spokesman Kristen Lee says the planes landed safely in Newark and Philadelphia. They've been moved to a remote location so law enforcement officials can investigate. And this is just one small bit of evidence that this remains an important issue for the United States. What could be plotted and planned in these areas?
Everybody's assuming that certainly in Europe and all of the countries like Britain, France, Holland, Canada, that are talking about pulling their troops out as soon as possible, they're all assuming we're in the end game in Afghanistan. And the key signifier of that has been the way in which talks are now clearly underway of some kind between Karzai and Taliban. There's even been reports of the U.S. facilitating the movement and flying people in for some of those talks, some Taliban people in. So it's a reminder that although the politicians and NATO seem to think it's an end game, as far as the Taliban or as far as al-Qaeda is concerned, maybe it isn't over.
I'm not sure that those talks, if they are going on at whatever level they're going on, are anything serious. You know, it's true that, as Richard Holbrooke has said, there are many different branches of the Taliban, and maybe some of them are talking to parts of the government. But Mullah Omar himself, who is the man at the top of that particular pyramid, is in no sense participating. And you have to look at who the Taliban are. It's a messianic sect that basically sees God-given right to rule Afghanistan, and exclusively. You can't actually negotiate with a group that refuses to respect a constitution, elections, rights of minorities, rights of women, unless you want to give away the store. And I think that the administration, I think they're talking about negotiations. I'm not sure whether they're going on, and I'm not sure whether they can actually withdraw on that schedule of July 11 if they're very serious.
But it's also, I think it's important for American, listeners in particular, this notion that the Taliban is some external force or it's just some small group. I think that perpetuates some of the, political debate here in a way that might not really get you to understand. This is part of the Pashtun tribes of Afghanistan identify themselves with this political movement. And as you said, those may be some of the folks who are talking to the Karzai government. Another part of the Taliban, as we would define it, are the ones who are still closely enmeshed with and working with al-Qaeda, along with a network of other groups, including Pakistani extremist groups. It's a very complicated fabric of different tribes and ethnic groups and, splinter groups that are all working together.
One of the things that Karzai has done has been to put together or to try to put together this peace council, which does seem to contain various sections of people who are ex-Taliban or close to the Taliban, who seem rather more moderate.
Right, those aren't probably the people who are sheltering Osama bin Laden.
Probably not.
You mentioned Pakistan, and one of the other stories that we're following this week is Secretary of State Clinton on a tour of the Far East to help prepare for President Obama's trip. Among his stops, his primary stop, is going to be India. And you cannot talk about India without talking about Pakistan and the delicacies here we've talked many, many times about the borderland between Pakistan and Afghanistan and how aggressively has Pakistani officials really tried to control exactly what you're talking about, search for Osama bin Laden, control the Taliban, which has sanctuary in these hills. But, Susan, talk about the delicate balancing act for the United States here, trying to curry good relations with India, a major economic force in this area, a stable democracy, allies. And yet, anytime you do anything nice to India, Pakistan goes nuts. So talk about that, the problem that Secretary of State Clinton and the president will face.
Absolutely. I think you're right to spotlight that as a huge issue and a delicate one for Obama right after the election. He's going to head off on this big trip. And, You know, India has really resisted the Obama administration's efforts, which they made, especially from the get-go. President Obama, when he was a candidate, Obama was very outspoken in the idea that you needed to have an India-Pakistan solution in order to move to a more stable regional solution. He wanted to talk about Kashmir, the disputed territory that has fueled several outright wars between India and Pakistan. He wanted to link those two up. He didn't want it to be an AFPAC conversation. He wanted it to be an Indo-PAC conversation. The Indians were so offended by this. They see themselves as a burgeoning global superpower, and you know, Pakistan is a sort of festering problem next door, but that they're not on the same level with them. They didn't even want Richard Holbrooke, who Roy mentioned, to come to India because his brief was AFPAC. And so I think even talking with the Indians about how do you contribute to a new regional stability with the Pakistanis. Kashmir has erupted over the last few months in some of the worst violence in several years. So you're not necessarily even going in the right direction at this point.
And the Indians certainly have an interest in the U.S. Success in Afghanistan. I think they're petrified of more terrorism coming out of that AFPAC region. And, you know, the problem is so much bigger than just Afghanistan.
They did suffer a terrorist attack.
It's just exactly 2 months ago, 2 years ago this month that the attacks occurred in Mumbai, and they really were traced to Pakistan, maybe not to the government as such, but certainly to Pakistan. And the truth is that in that border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, you have all sorts of plots being hatched and forces being trained against Pakistan as well as against the current Afghan government and also against India. And so the idea of the U.S. Withdrawing or starting to withdraw in July of 2011 and the rest of NATO doing it, I think, is for the Indians anathema.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Martin, I want you to pick up on another dimension of Secretary of State Clinton's trip. Yeah. and what we're going to see when President Obama goes, because the other major countries can visit is Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country, a place where he spent part of his youth. Mm-hmm. And we're hearing from the White House that he's going to use this trip to sort of revive and extend a theme that we heard early in his presidency, which is using his own story, his own Muslim relatives, his youth in Indonesia, to reach out to the Muslim world. That important speech he gave in Cairo, we're led to believe he will extend this message. Talk about that strategy from the White House and why it's so important to the president.
Well, there's been a double set of briefings from the White House. One is, as you say, this one about the president trying to make a personal reconnection with the Islamic world, in particular with this part of Southeast Asia, with the ASEAN countries, which are, of course, neither China nor India. They're in between. The other part of it, which has been very striking, is the way in which they're saying this trip is about jobs and that this is about U.S. exports and about trade. And, in fact, the president is taking with him next week to India the biggest ever delegation of U.S. CEOs ever to go on a presidential trip. It's an entire jumbo jet load. It's over 250 CEOs. They're talking about tens of billions of dollars in trade deals, and they've even come up with a rule of thumb that every $1 billion in exports is worth 11,000 jobs. And so it's, on the one hand, it's being packaged for domestic U.S. consumption. This is a jobs trip. On the other hand, it's being packaged as, this is Obama showing his ability to make a personal connection with people around the world. But the final, I think, really, really big point is that, as far as the Indians are concerned, is Obama really going to get serious about the burgeoning strategic alliance that George W. Bush tried to build with India, which is going to mean things like technology transfer on nuclear power, and also what's going to happen with the big trade deal, the big arms deal over India buying fighter jets. Will they buy American? We know they're going to be buying big Boeing C-17s and C-130s, but we'll see just how close the relationship gets.
And anytime you talk about an arms deal, that's when you start worrying about the sensibilities in Pakistan as well, because historically, the enmity between those two countries is number one on both countries' priority lists in terms of military readiness. Let me read an email from Alan, who's talking about Iran's bags of money. He says, given the state of the Iranian economy and past charges of Iranian economic sabotage, does anyone bother to check that these bags of cash aren't counterfeit? what do you think, Susan? And bring us up to date on Iran, because there are a number of stories relating to Iran this week as well, including the EU putting newer and tougher sanctions on the Iranian economy in terms of their nuclear development.
First of all, on the cash, I think it's probably fair to say that if Karzai has been accepting it all these years, then he's been checking pretty carefully to make sure his money's good somewhere.
There were euros, by the way, not dollars.
That's right.
It's always a good test. What cash does an insurgency want to take, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and the U.S. government, which also does pay out bags of cash in these situations.
Presumably,
you
they
know,
pay
they,
dollars.
They were, no, but they were famous for also paying out in Pakistani currency in the south of Afghanistan, where that was the sort of common currency, and not the dollar or certainly the euro, I think is not really in use in Kandahar, at least these days. Iran and sanctions. I think it will be interesting to see over the next few months. There are some interesting signs that there might be more willingness on the part to return to negotiations. Clearly, the U.S. has not entirely given up on that. I think what they want to do is do it in the context of the Security Council's great powers, the so-called P5 plus one. Obviously, they were very unhappy when Brazil and Turkey were going on their own in the effort to make a fuel swap deal with Iran. But I do think there's some interesting indications that you might see a new round of talks begin. And, you know, clearly in that context, perhaps the European move has something to do with that.
Can I just mention something about Iran and Afghanistan? They do have a legitimate interest in that country. And the U.S. should actually cultivate it and try to encourage them to be constructive.
That's Roy Gutman of McClatchy, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, Martin Walker of UPI. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and we'll be back with your call. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting catalogchoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Patti Smith talks about the late 60s when she wanted to be an artist and found a kindred spirit in another would-be artist, Robert Mapplethorpe. Her memoir, Just Kids, has been nominated for a National Book Award and is out in paperback next week. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. And for the second hour of our Friday News Roundup focused on foreign policy, Roy Gutman of McClatchy, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, Martin Walker of UPI. And let's turn to some of our callers and get their views. And Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're first. Welcome.
Thank you. I was thinking my question was in regard to the war and And really, to call it a war is almost to do dishonor to whatever honor resides in the word war. But what's going on in Afghanistan? I mean, you're paying. They're paying, and I heard talk of this a few months ago, where they were paying warlords to not attack them, to not attack the troops. It seems to me that every dime spent there is wasted. As soon as the U.S. troops get out of there, it's going to collapse. It's already collapsed. I mean, there's no whatever's being sustained there, whatever little sustainability there is going to disappear. I mean, they're comparing this thing to the Vietnam situation, but really that's an unfair comparison, because at least in Vietnam you were dealing with some sort of rational government. At least there was some sort of situation where you'd say, you know, we promise to do this. There's not even the guise of a promise in this case. As soon as the United States leaves, the place is going to go crazy again.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim. Roy, you've studied this a lot. Answer Jim's question and talk about whether this is a mood we're seeing more and more that is helping to erode public support for continued U.S. deployment, not only from the point of view of the mission there, but the cost. I mean, the caller says all of our money is being wasted. Are we hearing that more and more?
Well, the picture on the ground is not very attractive, and Jim is completely right about, you know, you have a government that is in many ways corrupt. You have, and it's ineffective. Its writ doesn't extend very far. It doesn't, and its support in the country is questionable, because it really used fraudulent means, at least in part, to get elected. But for the United States, you know, you have to take the long view. We are the sole superpower out there. And if you look at that region and what happens when the United States pulls out, then you see a disaster. I mean, the whole 9/11 event occurred after a decade in which the United States completely withdrew from Afghanistan and from even supporting Pakistan. Don't forget, in the 1980s, the United States was the principal supporter of the so-called Mujahideen, the fighters who resisted and eventually chased out the Russian occupation. It's one of the greatest events, in fact, of the late 20th century that this happened, and it helped lead to the end of communism. It helped lead to the fall of communism, certainly in Eastern Europe. And the U.S.'s reaction to that was after 1989, after the Russians pulled out, after you had the fall of communism, was to leave, was to pull out. And so in the 1990s, that's when you had a civil war. We had no participation, no involvement, no support for any side, and Al-Qaeda arrives. Do we want to see that film one more time? I don't think so.
But the question that our caller was raising was not the geopolitical one, geopolitical in terms of the situation in Afghanistan, but what he was raising was whether Barack Obama really wants to run for re-election with an open-ended commitment in terms of troops and money to a country where Americans are increasingly dubious about the legitimacy and the success of the mission.
And it's not just Americans. I mean, remember that next month, after his India trip, next month President Obama is going to be in Lisbon for a big NATO summit, and one of the big issues there with the other NATO leaders is going to be how long will they carry on?
Right. And what we talked earlier about the French already starting to
the French, get cold the feet. Dutch, the Canadians, the Brits, they've all started to draw it down.
Let's talk to Bill in Edwardsville, Illinois. Welcome.
Yes, I was interested to hear the topic come up of how United States funds the contractors, and then the contractors in turn, you know, fund the Taliban. And there's another way that the U.S. government funds the Taliban. That's when we fund Pakistan's military, which funds their intelligence agency, the ISI, which then turns around and funds the Taliban. So we have the bizarre situation where American tax dollars and American debt is being used to fund the very people who our troops are fighting. So how are our troops supposed to succeed in Afghanistan when the government of the U.S. the United States is funding the enemy?
Bill, good question. Susan Glasser.
Well, look, I think the caller is right on the mark in suggesting the nature of the cycle of this sort of corrupt and very violent situation we find ourselves in. You can think of it almost as a sort of a money bubble in a place that otherwise wouldn't have any of these funds. So our own money is, in fact, clearly being used to support the insurgency. It's being used to support the Taliban. It's being used to support the drug dealers. Because this money wouldn't otherwise be in Pakistan or Afghanistan, we've flooded it with billions and billions of dollars in a system where the power relationships are such, the nature of corruption is such, that the people who put their hands on those dollars are the very people who are causing the situation in the first place.
A couple of other stories that have been making news this week that we want to touch on. Roy, the a court in Tehran sentenced Tariq Aziz to death, a familiar figure to many Americans who follow international politics. He was on TV often as a spokesman and defender. Saddam Hussein, just interestingly, the only Christian in Saddam Hussein's cycle. He was sentenced to death this week. Your take on that story?
Well, I don't know quite what happened in the trial. I didn't see in all of the news articles I searched for and read, and we ourselves carried a Christian Science Monitor story from Baghdad, just what happened in the trial itself and whether due process was violated, whether in fact there was in any way a fair trial, whether the facts came out and what the facts really are. But I will say, from everything I know of Tariq Aziz, he was a fairly he was the front man for the Saddam Hussein regime, but a major player in terms of ordering the killings of various minorities, and certainly the Shiites in the party of now Prime Minister Maliki. I don't know that he actually played that role. And one does have the feeling that of a kind of a political revenge. It's like the Saddam Hussein sentencing itself several years ago. They put him on trial for one major incident, and that was the killing of people in Prime Minister Maliki's Dawa party. But they failed to come to account with him on some of the other major things. For example, the killing of Kurds and many other terrible atrocities. And the whole system doesn't look from the outside like it's functioning in a due process manner.
The judge was Mahmoud Salih, who's a member of the Shiite coalition.
We have an email on a topic I know, Martin, you want to talk about. This is from Greg Foran. I was wondering if the panel could speak about the death of former Argentine President Néstor Kirchner earlier this week, very suddenly at age 60 from a heart attack, how this would may impact politics and society in Argentina.
Well, immediately not a lot, because his wife is currently the president and is running the country and doing reasonably well because of the boom.
He was always considered her closest advisor and potential successor.
And potential successor and the power behind the throne, as it were. I think he was also a very important figure in South America. More generally, he was made the Secretary General of this new Union of South America that the Brazilians were promoting and that Chavez of Venezuela was promoting. He was seen as somebody who had defied the IMF and got away with it, somebody who had defaulted upon Argentina's sovereign debt and got away with it. And I think it was very odd that we saw, I think it was a 13% jump in the rise of Argentine shares on the world markets yesterday when the news came out of his death, when in fact I don't think there's any chance at all of Argentina's policies changing, certainly not this side of the next election. And if there is to be a successor, it's probably going to be a fairly unsavoury trade union thug from the Peronist movement, who are now once again the dominant force in Argentina. Poor Argentina, once again, it's got a real deficit of decent political leadership.
Let's turn to some more of our callers. And Tom in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Tom.
Yeah, thanks. I'm trying to clear up exactly who attacked us on 9/11 here. Mr. Roberts, you mentioned that it was all hashed out in Afghanistan, but I'm in the middle of a New Yorker article right now called The Mastermind, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has claimed responsibility for masterminding. I think it's general knowledge. I'm wondering what his relationship was to Osama bin Laden. He actually, in the article, it says he actually never even swore allegiance to Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda. Can you and your guests comment on that and find, just clarify exactly where this plot was hashed and why we're in Afghanistan if KSM was the one who was responsible?
Okay, go ahead, Susan.
Well, I think what the caller is referring to is the fact that KSM, as he's known, was in fact a well-known terrorist operator on his own before he joined forces with al-Qaeda. And so there's some testimony that several years previous to this, he had already been contemplating a plot involving airliners. There had been an aborted meeting in Asia. But at that point, he joined forces with al-Qaeda. There is ample documented evidence. You can go back and look in the 9/11 Commission report, for example, and you will see a fairly detailed account of how bin Laden himself and his other chief lieutenants were involved as well in the plot, although there has not been evidence to dispute the fact that KSM was the overall sort of architect and leader of this plan.
Okay, let's turn to Douglas in Herndon, Virginia. Doug, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. It's a first-time call, and I'm sorry I'm missing Diane, but Roy and the rest of the guests are terrific. And my question is this. Won't France's withdrawal at this time embolden Osama bin Laden and these other terrorist groups to issue these public threats? And secondly, will other soldiers be put in their place, or will the Americans have to step up and add the additional 3,500 or more troops? And maybe did bin Laden even know about the timing of the announcement by the Sarkozy government?
Okay, thanks. Roy?
Well, the problem, as Martin also pointed out earlier, for the United States is by setting a date for the beginning of the withdrawal, you basically tell the allies that it's safe for them to say the same thing, and that's really what the French are doing. If the U.S. Decides come July 2011 that, in fact, it's got to be a much slower process, it will have to convince its allies also to follow suit. As I say, the July 11th date was probably arranged or decided largely for domestic political reasons rather than for the strategic aim of changing the equation in Afghanistan. At that point, they're going to have to make a political judgment whether the political traffic here can bear an extension.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We also have a news coming over the wire just now related to an earlier topic that says that the French unions say they have voted to end strikes at oil refineries and major ports. Martin, you were talking about the power of French unions. Is this an indication that the Sarkozy government is gaining traction with some of its changes here?
I think so, yes. The numbers of people turning out on the strikes have been dwindling. The ability to try and bring life to a halt by trying to close the refineries and some of the petrol stations seems to have failed, and the unions seem to have accepted that. What's been really interesting has been the way in which the French Socialist Party, which is the official opposition and the ones who want eventually to replace Sarkozy, have been very careful not to throw all of their weight behind this trade union action. Indeed, when Ségolène Royal, who was the Socialist Party candidate against Sarkozy for the presidential elections last time, when she was asked where she stood on this issue, she simply said, if you'd elected me, then we wouldn't have been in this mess in the first place.
Let's turn to Jeff in Framingham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I wanted to speak about again about Afghanistan and about one of the panel's explanation of what occurred there. But it was, in fact, at a point when Russia was being totally demolished and could no longer keep their troops there, that there was a general agreement of leaving Afghanistan neutral. And there's this strange recurrence, as in Vietnam, the French get trounced, they leave, we come in, and we receive the same results. Now we're in Afghanistan following the Russians' defeat, fighting the people who we supported, the Mujahideen, who then transformed into various other sections, and who we armed and who we supported. And now we are in that same position. There is no explanation of why we are in Afghanistan. If it's for 9/11, That's absurd, because if we wanted to attack the place where the plot was hatched, it was hatched in Germany and the United States.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. Susan, this is about the third caller we've gotten, and there are several others on the line voicing similar feelings about what really is America's national interest at stake in Afghanistan. Is it continued to be worth the casualties, the money, as one of our callers pointed out? When you start having stories about bags of cash at a time of great budget crunch in the United States, this is all part of a growing dilemma for the Obama administration in terms of, as Roy was saying earlier, balancing the military needs and security needs on the ground with the political situation here.
There's no question that the clock is really ticking here. The military has made some efforts, I think fairly unsuccessfully, to reposition it and say, well, it's not that we've been fighting 9 years unsuccessfully in Afghanistan. It's really only in the last year or so that we've embraced a counterinsurgency method, that we've taken it seriously. They've tried to, without too explicitly, in effect, say we were distracted by the war in Iraq. Now we're concentrating on Afghanistan. Clearly, as these callers reflect, a large swath of the American public is not buying it. President Obama himself, if you read the fairly stark portrayal in Bob Woodward's new book, for example, mm-hmm. you get a real sense of a president who feels trapped and unhappy with his options and working, scrambling even behind the scenes to produce a different menu of options than his own advisors and his own Pentagon offered him when it came to the Afghan war. This July 2011 thing, what's so striking in Woodward's account is that President Obama himself came up with it. He wasn't offered it.
That's Susan Glasser, from the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Also with me this morning, Martin Walker, writes for Foreign Affairs for United Press International, and Roy Gutman, he's the foreign editor of McClatchy, and also the author of How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thank you, our wonderful audience, for spending part of your morning with us.